in just seconds, our very good friend, Chris Schultz. The first time this season.
What?
Well, Schultz, who's going to break down, well, we'll talk about the teams and the games coming up. Doesn't mean we can't throw the odd memory in there. Schultz will remember this.
And now, a classic Grey Cup moment, brought to you by Schnooters Luncheon Meats.
In the most hype season in CFL history, one Raghib the Rocket Ismail landed upon Canadian soil, ushered in by the new Hollywood connection, McNall, Candy, and Gretzky, owners of the Toronto Argos. Signing for a record $16 million, the Rocket would earn every penny. The 1991 Grey Cup would be a seesaw battle that was only decided by a magnificent 87-yard fourth-quarter kick return for a touchdown. But that was not the only note of significance. Winnipeg resident Raleigh Borgenchuk, upon seeing the surprising Ismail run back, heaved a can of Molson Export at the streaking player all the way from the Upper West Grandstand, Section 101, Seat 4. Although not hitting the Rocket, it was the greatest beer can throw in the history of the game.
This classic Grey Cup moment, brought to you by Schnooters Luncheon Meats. Hey, how's your Schnooters?
And now from TSN, we go to Chris Schultz. Morning, Schultzy.
Hey, good morning. I remember that so well.
You know, watching it on television as a fan, at first it appeared to be a snowball.
Yes, and really did. And I thought it was a snowball, too. And we really didn't find out till the next day. And then when we watched it on the telecasts over and over again, you could see that the beer and the way it kind of rotated around and around and around. Not that I've thrown beer cans and I've observed how beer explodes out of a beer can, but it rotated and we're like, oh my God, that isn't a snowball at all. It really was a beer can.
You know, it was a charmed year, but when you look at it, and certainly you being a part of it, it wasn't as easy as people probably remember. I mean, I think people look back at that team and see the incredible talent. They see the Hollywood ownership. I mean, everything seemed to be in the right place at the right time, and it really was a fun year to not only watch the CFL, but, you know, be a part of it. But you know what? There was a lot of work, and it was not a walk in the park to not only get there, but to win the thing. It was a very engaging year.
Well, I remember so well the amount of hype, the amount of publicity that year, 1991, going to training camp, and there was more media, more television cameras, more reporters than around any other football experience I've had other than being with the Dallas Cowboys, which was similar. And it was such a novelty because you had the different personalities. You had Bruce McNall, which we all thought was this slick, polished, highly successful businessman. You had Wayne Gretzky, who was the icon of Canada, and you had John Candy, who to this day probably was the most amiable, kindest, yet strongest person that I've ever been associated with in any form of the entertainment industry. And they just created such a wonderful feeling. And the truth was, the first half of the season, we were pretty good, but we were by no means great. And then the second half of the season, it all kind of fell into place. And I don't know if the word was chemistry, I don't know if it was cooperation, but I do know in football that you're so interdependent on one another for individual success that sometimes when you start believing that and you accept it as players, you truly start working with one another for the benefit of the team. And that's kind of what happened to us in that second half of the year. And I think that's what every CFL team is striving for, is that unique level of chemistry, a feeling you get where people are willing to sacrifice their personal glory for somebody else's success, for the team's success. But it was by far the most enjoyable experience I've ever had in football.
Hey, and speaking of which, great to have you on the show here this morning.
Yeah, buddy, I've been around my phone waiting for phone calls, and I'm still lonely.
Oh, I see. It's my fault now. Oh. Well, you know, it's funny. You talk about the Argos and just sort of the tradition, which has not been there in the last several years. Jim Barker comes in, who we know has always been a great personnel guy. But he's a very learned football guy as well. I don't think people give him credit for, you know, the kind of football that he knows. And I think what might have surprised people is that there is a fire to him. If you saw him on the sidelines on a couple of occasions, that might be a Jim Barker that you're not used to, but it comes down to this. Football is played that way. It's really tough to be passive for the 3 hours on that sideline, and there are times where you do need to light that fire. And generally, it's not because of anger. It's because of not playing up to the standard and the quality in which that coaching staff prepares you for game in and game out, and it wasn't happening. So he had to let them know that. And I think for a lot of fans, and certainly here in Calgary, they probably hadn't seen that before.
Well, I think you nailed it right there. It's not really a personal issue. It's more that sometimes coaches get immensely frustrated when players don't live up to their expectation. And you got to remember, this is pro football. And I never considered football fun. I considered it a challenge. And I got addicted to the challenge of the process of preparation, the performance on game day, and then the reevaluation the day after with film analysis, and that never-ending desire to improve. And when coaches see their players regress, they take that personally. And I think Coach Barker's greatest asset is he's pretty doggone good when it comes to personnel specific for the Canadian Football League. And I think his second asset is his determination to make this work in the Canadian Football League, and more specifically in the city of Toronto. And you have to be careful, because if you become overly confrontive with football players at the pro level, you got to remember, you're dealing with grown men that have families, that have mortgages. It's different than when you're dealing with college kids who are living a more idealistic mindset. And if you tell a college kid to jump, he's going to jump, and then he's going to ask you if that was high enough. If you tell a pro football player to jump, he's going to say, well, how high do you want it, on what direct angle, and why? So you do have to pick and choose your spots. But, you know, I see John Huffnagel on the sidelines, and I would not consider John, how do you say this, a nice football coach. I think he's a demanding football coach, and that's the way it should be. You look at Richie Hall with Edmonton, and what is the one criticism that Richie's got? Well, is he too nice? Wally Buono with the BC Lions. I'm telling you, you know, Wally's a good guy, but he will cut you in a heartbeat if you are not playing up to the potential that he perceives you should be. So there is a time and a place, and I think Jim Barker had the right time and the right place. And fortunately for the Argonauts, it worked, and it makes for a very interesting game tonight with them and the Alouettes.
It's funny that you mentioned, you know, sort of sideline temperament. And I think it was last week where I brought up the name Frank Cush. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, the problem is, you know, his military sort of background and the way he'd berate kids was one thing in the state of Arizona. I think, was it the Arizona State?
It was Arizona State, yeah. Sun Devils. I don't like them very much.
But. Yeah, I guess you wouldn't. But then he comes in, and on that very gifted Ticat team, he comes in, the first thing he tells them, you know, when they can eat, you know, don't spat your shoes. And I thought, you know, the disconnect would have been almost immediate. Now, strangely enough, you know, Tommy Clements had that great year, and they were like 13-3, but it was almost in spite of a guy that they absolutely despised, because they started to lose respect as a professional because they weren't kids anymore. And as you mentioned beforehand, you just can't tell grown-up professionals to, you know, go to bed.
You know, Michael, look at your job. If your boss was constantly on you and saying, this is what I liked about you, this is what I didn't like about you, here's what you need to improve on, and this is why you need to improve on, and I thought this was a funny bit, but I didn't think this was a funny bit, why don't you have Chris Schultz on more? Why don't you have him on less? You know, after a while, you're going to be saying, you know, do you want to do the job?
Yeah.
And after a while, you're walking on eggshells just trying to do your job and trying to earn your paycheck to the best of your ability. And I think sometimes if you over-aggressively push football players, they're like, well, fine. You know, there is this two-word thing called free agency, and they actually start looking at it. But it's a fine line, because every now and then, you know, it's a game. And it's a game that in some ways in mentality is childlike. And you got to whip the child sometimes and say, you are not living up to expectations. You are in a state of complacency, or you're providing a penalty that is killing us. Wake up. I've had it happen to me, especially at the college level, and it works. But if you do the Frank Cush thing and you grind and you grind and you grind, then the players fall into a survival mentality. They don't have a performance mentality, because you're taking all the fun out of the game. It is a business. There is no idea, but it is a game on game day. And I'm a true believer that football players play their best when they perceive it on game day as a business, and when they perceive it during practice as a job.
We're in conversation with Chris Schultz from TSN here in the Fan 960 and Fan960.com. You had mentioned John Huffnagel and that coaching staff that, you know, demands a level of play, and it doesn't matter who you are. At the beginning of the year, a lot of people made, you know, something out of the comments made publicly by Huff towards Mike Lobinjo. But as Huff has been on the show, he said, look, it's the same expectation that all players have, and they get into that game last week against Saskatchewan, and you know what it's like when you feel like you haven't beat a team in a while. Oh, it yeah. starts to get in your head a little bit, the players' faces. I mean, if you're in that trench, you're looking at those same guys all the time, and if you hadn't beat them, it does get between the ears. And as they say, it's a prize fight. You know, it's like fighting Floyd Mayweather. It's tough to land a punch. But last week, the Stampeders, they landed a bunch, and they punched them right in the mouth.
They did, and you could see that the three games they played previously in the short time period, there was a lot of conversation, and rightfully so. Guys, this is our grind. This is the 3 weeks where you guys are less than 3 weeks have really got to stay 110% focused and try to get the most out of these 3 weeks. And they won two and they lost one. But it was a completely different team, the way they opened up and the way they played against the Riders. And that was a very good Riders team. If I'm not mistaken, it was 7-7 at halftime. It was really close football game. And then in the second half, Calgary took it over, if for no other reason, was their own execution, their own concentration, and their own ability to play really good football. And part of that is how well that they were prepared. They had the 10 days in between, and part of it was just rising to the challenge that is the Riders when they come into Calgary and how well they played. So, yes, that was a big win, and it sets up an interesting game because Winnipeg is coming off an Edmonton team. I don't know if Winnipeg beat Edmonton as much as Edmonton just didn't show up. So Winnipeg has to come into the stadium in Calgary, McMahon, with a sense of humility because they're not as good as they looked last week, where I think Calgary definitely took a step forward.
Well, you mentioned Edmonton, and to me, I'm having a tough time figuring out why there is this almost disconnect with the players they have on that team, Schultz, because, you know, you got Ricky Ray, you've got a lot of offensive weapons. In the first couple of weeks, Edmonton certainly were stopping people after the first 2-3 weeks, and yet there's this implosion somehow, and people say, you know, do they equate it to what happens on the sidelines? Is it a general manager's responsibility because those are the players on the field? But at some point, it's got to be about execution, Schultz. I mean, the coaches can't catch the ball for the guys, but there seems to be meltdowns now in different areas. And for continuity, which is what you want from your team, they don't have any.
Well, you know what? It's really not that difficult to assess. You know, first of all, is it the coaches? Are they teaching them the right technique? Is the offensive line coach being effective in his philosophy on how to pass block, run block? The defensive staff, the offensive staff, the special team coach, or is it the system? You know, the way they approach the game, what they're emphasizing, what they're de-emphasizing, the way their defense is run, the way their special teams are run, the philosophy of. The third aspect, is it the talent of the players? Are the players just good enough? And I'm sure that, you know, they've gone over their personnel and regraded them, and, you know, some guys are on the bubble and some guys probably have some sense of security, but when I looked at, you know, the one thing a football player has to be able to control, and I think it is the huge difference between why some football players excel and have careers and other football players play well in spurts and fade, is your mindset going into the game. This is an apex sport. There's no other team sport that where you have as much preparation time and practice time, and there's no reason why you should not be emotionally ready. But the classification of what is emotionally ready, well, for me, it was you got to take time out, you have to change your personality, and you have to develop a level of determination, a desire within you that you are going to play your absolute best within the context of football in association with the players you play closest to, and there's nothing going to stop you. And you got to use a little bit of self-speak, and you got to do what you have to do to psych yourself up and get you in the right mindset. And I question if the Edmonton Eskimo players take the time out, that 3 hours when they get to the locker room and before kickoff, to get themselves in the right mindset. It's the conscious effort to get yourself emotionally ready that I think is absent. And it's something we'll discuss probably Friday night, but I don't think there's anything wrong with the coaches. I don't think there's anything wrong with the systems. Perhaps the talent of the players, and they've made a couple changes, is an issue. But more than anything else, hey, Mike, if you want something bad enough for a period of time and you're willing to go through a brick wall to get it, you'll do it. And what separates the good teams from the average teams and the below-average teams is the mentality of the player and how they look at their job. Do they treat it as life and death? Now, you know, and I know, it is not life and death, but you got to trick yourself into believing it is. And then all of a sudden, you have second effort, you have third effort, you have enthusiasm, you have desire. You start punching them, and then instead of them punching you, which was what Rick Lalisher said, and I think it was a very, very accurate description. So if somebody's punching you first, are you ready for that? And I don't think Edmonton was.
You know, you bring up mindset, which is just so important. You know, there's that enormous physical aspect to and sacrifice when you play the game of football. But between the years, the almost how you perceive yourself, I'm just curious, looking at the Hamilton Tiger Cats, who really had the big turnaround last year and were able to bring back a core group of players where Marcel Belfay was now able to look at sort of backups and the odd hole or now look at depth in terms of his team instead of trying to figure out who those starters are. And so you have these huge expectations after a turnaround season, and sometimes that leads to, I don't know if you perceive yourself to maybe being better than what you are. I'm just curious, have you ever been on a team where there was a turnaround and then the expectations were high the next year and it doesn't happen?
Oh, 100%. 1987, we lost the Grey Cup. 1988, we were 14-4, and the very next year we fell apart. and I don't know what it is. The only thing I can explain is sometimes the worst thing that can happen to a team is when they're receiving the ball and they take the opening kickoff all the way back for a touchdown. There's a subtle lull on your bench that scored. I mean, you're happy that you scored the opening touchdown. It looks so easy, but it takes the edge off. And when you think about athletics and you think about all sports, it really comes down to certain mental, physical edges that you have as an individual or you have collectively. So there is something to having excessive positive publicity that you read and you start to ingest into yourself individually, and you start to believe the BS. You really do. Rather than just disregarding what, you know, you, me, and other people that make our living in the media say, and just stay focused on what you have to do. It's a perception of yourself, it's a perception of your team, and it's focusing just on internally what is happening on your team, not externally what everyone is saying about you.
Schulze, always great to have you on the show, but we have to mention, Tackle Hunger.
Later, Tackle Hunger for the citizens of Calgary. It's this week. Please come up, take a lap of the stadium at McMahon. Before you head to the stadium, just go to your local cupboard and find something that you don't want because other people do want it. We've had a lot of success so far. Winnipeg raised 49,250 pounds of food. Regina, 69,500 pounds of food. Come on, Calgary. Even if you are somewhere in between, I'll be proud of you. And understand, it really helps kids. There's a lot of kids that use this program, and it breaks your heart when you're at the local food bank, as I have been, and you see kids scrambling for food. So, come on out and help your local citizens. It's a wonderful program, something I'm very proud of, and it makes a difference. And I will promise you this. Sometimes you give money or you give certain aspects to charity, you're not 100% sure that it goes to the right source. I will guarantee you it goes to the right source because I've been in the food banks in Calgary, and they're magnificent in how well they are run.
Schulze, maybe you should be on the show every day.
I get lonely, man. Yeah. I just said my routine is I read my computer notes every morning. Nobody calls.
That's sad too. That's two sad stories.
Sad, man.
In 30 seconds, you're
exactly.
You're like a UNICEF commercial all of a sudden. Hey, you take care, and I will talk to you again real soon, my friend.
Anytime,
I guarantee
buddy,
that.
Anytime.